Good afternoon. It's Friday the 8th of March 2024, just after 1 o'clock. Welcome to UK Column News. I'm your host, Mike Robinson. Joining me today by video link, we have Ben Rubin and Debbie Evans. We're going to get started today with war and defence and the fallout from the Jeremy Hunt exercise on Wednesday with respect to defence, because some people upset about the lack of rise in defence spending. So let's just remind ourselves what our friendly defence secretary, otherwise known as Secretary of State for War, Grant Shapps, said just a few weeks ago. We're moving from a post-war world into a pre-war world because they are creating the circumstances for war as we speak. But of course, he was claiming that defence spending was going up. Marc Francois, on the other hand, from the Defence Select Committee, saying, actually, not really. He said, nobody seems to have told HM Treasury, does Russia have to get to Warsaw before we start spending what we need for defence? So Marc Francois still very keen to push the narrative that Russia is the big problem. But don't worry, Shapps went off to Ukraine yesterday and met with Zelensky. Because they are, of course, about to spend even more money over there. So they decided that they wanted to... Sorry, let's just go back. They decided they want... This is going to do this again, isn't it? Let's play the video. They said they're going to step up support for Ukraine with a package of £325 million for cutting-edge drones to help fight Putin's illegal invasion. And we're going to talk a little bit more about drones towards the end of this segment, but 10,000 drones are saying researched and developed in the UK. This is all about delivering material to the front. So the investment is going to deliver more than 10,000 drones for the armed forces in Ukraine to harness, this is their words, the UK's world-leading defence industries to deliver advanced new drone capabilities to Ukraine throughout 2024. And this is a significant boost to the £200 million drone package announced by Sunak in January. It's now £325 million overall funding, and it's, as they said many times now, 10,000 drones, including 1,000 one-way attack drones, suicide drones. But in the meantime, of course, NATO in the headlines. You got a bit of a preview for this, but everybody is getting extremely concerned that Donald Trump is likely to be the next president of the United States. And of course, as we were pointing out a week or two ago, he is very keen that European countries start spending some money. And he is saying that if the European countries don't start spending some money, then he is going to withdraw the United States from NATO. So the RUSI article here is called 2% Won't Cut It. Ursula von der Leyen, of course, is up for re-election at the moment as the European Commissioner. She's been put forward by her party to stand again. And so it's very, very likely that she's going to end up in a second term in that role. But in the meantime, she's becoming more Hitler-like on a daily basis. So let's just have a listen to what she had to say about defence spending in Europe.
Security in Europe also means doing more on our own defence. Our common goal should be very clear. We need to turbocharge our defence industrial capacity in the next 5 years. And at the heart of this must be one simple principle. Europe must spend more, Europe must spend better, and Europe must spend European. And this will help us fill the urgent need to rebuild, replenish, and modernize member states' armed forces, and to keep supporting Ukraine. And in doing so, Europe should strive to develop and manufacture the next generation of battle-winning operational capabilities. And my friends, the EPP is the party that has championed a Europe that can defend itself. And we will be the party that delivers on a defense union. And this topic needs undivided attention. And therefore, we need a designated defense commissioner for the next mandate. This is one of our EPP's deliverables. My friends, throughout our history, Europe has never had security or prosperity.
Well, Indeed, they haven't. Sorry, I just left that little bit at the end there, a bit of a running joke. But defence union absolutely back on the table once again. European Union being pushing extremely hard for this for so many, many years. The question is, what will the UK's involvement be in that? But Donald Trump being used as the excuse to reinvigorate the drive forward. In the meantime, of course, NATO continues to expand. Sweden has given up its sovereignty yesterday. And here is the Swedish Prime Minister handing over the various documentation to Blinken. So NATO, Sweden officially joining NATO yesterday, because, of course, as we've mentioned many times, there's no such thing as NATO expansionism. Lots of people very excited about it. Various tweets going out, including from the Ministry of Defence. And I'm going to apologise now, because I appreciate that it is lunchtime and many people would be having something to eat right now. But we do have to have a look at what Rishi Sunak had to say about this.
We should be proud that NATO is the most successful defensive alliance in history. It has kept us all safe for three quarters of a century, and it has never been more important than it is today. The accession of Sweden into NATO following Finland just a few months ago is a historic moment for the whole alliance. Like Finland, Sweden shares our values and principles, and they share our unwavering commitment to international security in the face of Russia's threats and their barbaric war in Ukraine. Sweden and Finland's membership will make NATO stronger and the whole Euro-Atlantic more secure.
So hopefully you've managed to keep your lunch down as you were watching that. But in the meantime, in Germany, the whole Taurus missile scandal, the leaks, continues to rumble on. And Britain absolutely getting the blame for this in many ways. But here is Colonel Ralph Thiel. He is a military expert in Germany. And he's saying that Germany shouldn't be driven into the war by the British. He said the British are the drivers of a belligerent solution to the problem, i.e. to bring the Russians to their knees through war. We should not allow ourselves to be driven by the British. So that's in this interview with NTV. He was then interviewed by Focus Online, where he said, basically, there are two suspects who could have intercepted the conversation. This is the leaked conversation over Taurus and circulated it. One is the Western states. They could have an interest in undermining Chancellor Scholz's cautious approach, since hybrid warfare, in which the British, for example, are also masters, is preferably conducted via third parties. Nothing is as it seems at first. So the Germans starting to look in our direction for what's going on with them. But let's come back to the issue of drones, because a number of years ago, Squadron 216 Squadron was set up as, or re-stood up as, an experimental squadron looking forward to our swarming drones capability within the RAF. And at the time, or a couple of years later, Sir Mike Wigston, the Chief of the Air Staff, said, our drone test squadron, 216 Squadron, has proved beyond doubt the disruptive and innovative utility of swarming drones under our Alvina program. He went on to say, working with our defense science laboratory and specialist industry partners, I can say that we've exercised swarms of over 20 ultra-low-cost drones operating together against threat systems to brilliant effect. So this was his claim in 2021. Unfortunately, a parliamentary question was asked by Stuart MacDonald from the Scottish Nationalist Party a few days ago, and the Ministry of Defence made this response. Since the formation of 216 Squadron in 2020, there have been no completed tests or trials conducted either in-house or with industry. No UAVs have been recommended by 216 Squadron for acquisition into service. So I'm not quite sure who was telling fibs between the two of them, but somebody is. I suspect James Cartledge here is a bit more correct. And I suspect that our capability isn't quite what the Chief of the Air Staff would like it to be. But Debbie, let's welcome you to the program and talk about drones on a more commercial basis.
Yes, well, we've covered them before. And as you very kindly covered military, let's look at commercial drones. And we're talking drones for deliveries like Amazon, the post office, the NHS. So if we go to the government website, we can see they've got an advancing airborne autonomy, commercial drones saving money and saving lives in the UK. But looking further into the report, what we can see actually is that PricewaterhouseCoopers estimate by 2030, now, wait for this. These are pretty sort of like gobsmacking statistics, I think. 900,000 drones will be in the UK skies. Now, this is commercial drones. This is nearly 1 million drones. And that drones will contribute to 45 billion of the UK economy and will create 600,000 jobs. And of course, it's all to save money. The diagram that's next coming up will show you where drones will be used. So you're going to be looking at drones for surveys and inspections. So to look at infrastructure and bridges and towers, and delivery drones, which will be your medicines, NHS, blood samples, etc., and then your emergency responses. So those are the kind of the three uses for drones. But let's take you to Altitude Angel, because Altitude Angel are launching, and we'll go into it in a bit more in a minute. But if you're living in the Reading, Oxford, Milton Keynes, Cambridge, Coventry, or Rugby areas, you'll want to take specific note of this, because you're going to have a superhighway right over your heads, 165 miles of it. This has been launched by the BT, British Telecom, Project Skyway. They wrote the white paper, The Future of Flight Drone Technology. And if we look at and into about the report and about the authors, we can see that it was led by the BT-led consortium with Project Accelerate. So what actually is Project Accelerate? So Project Accelerate basically is a clinical trial for drones. If you just think about a medical clinical trial, this is exactly what BT have been doing. They've been project leading this whole agenda. But did you know that, these are a few interesting statistics, did you know that only 11% actually of the population know a lot about drones? The rest of us know very little, or actually not a lot. And did you know that 74% of the public think that drones are for photographs and videos, and 65% of the public think that drones are toys? So it's just over half, really, of us that are aware that they're used for military. But the knowledge on drones drops significantly as you go further down. But also the concerns that the public have over drones. And you can see that most of the concerns are over privacy and entering private property, 48% on privacy, and only 18%, I was surprised to hear, on noise. And we'll come to noise in a minute. And with regards to public acceptance, it seems that the public will accept that we can use drones for missing persons, firefighting, crime scenes, and inspecting infrastructure. But actually, we don't want to use them for deliveries and the NHS and the Royal Mail and all of these other things that they want to roll in. We don't actually want it. But I just want you to listen. I only took 10 seconds of this video because, quite honestly, 10 seconds is enough. But this is just the sound of one drone. Have a listen to this. And just imagine, I'm sure there won't be 900,000 in the sky all at once, but there will be quite a few. When you look up, it will be a completely different landscape. So Altitude Angel brought out a little video just to give you a taster of what life is set to be like.
In the 1800s, the rail network expansion fueled significant industrial growth. Connecting towns and naval ports together brought revolutionary efficiencies to the movement of goods and people, spawning entirely new industries and businesses. Today, we begin the next industrial and commercial revolution, automated flight. The Skyway system establishes a network of superhighways up to 10 kilometers wide, with the first main route spanning 265 kilometers between Reading and Coventry. Soon, time-sensitive transportation of medical items and organs, fire, medical and police scenarios as well as the delivery of high-value, low-volume goods, can start to be moved by automated drone, unlocking the vast potential of drones to transform lives and revolutionize business. Skyway has safety and privacy at its core. Powerful sensors on the ground looking up detect crewed and uncrewed aviation traffic and create a real-time moving map of the sky above, which is relayed to the Skyway controller in the cloud, where it is used to provide automated air traffic control for drones flying on the superhighway, preventing collisions. Drones can enter or exit the Skyway anywhere along the route, bringing access to millions of businesses and citizens. Automated flight. Anywhere and for everyone. Just imagine.
Coming to a town or city close to you very soon.
Indeed. Thank you, Debbie. Thank you very much. Ben, let's say hello to you. Where do we move on to from there?
Well, if you want a drone network, you need the telecommunications infrastructure to run it on. So let's find out about GSMA.
It all started with a voice.
Hello.
Hello.
What are you doing?
But one voice has been there since the very beginning. We are the GSMA. Together with our members, we make connectivity work for all. Uniting over 1,100 operators and companies to drive innovation, policy, and standards in mobile connectivity. Whether it's our global working groups, who accelerate growth in future networks and enhance security in our digital lives, or our world-class event, connecting policymakers and change makers.
And we are super excited
to power progress in digital transformation. We've been transforming the world for 30 years, but we've only just started. We are the GSMA.
That reminds me a little bit of the Huawei video we were showing on Wednesday.
It's of the same provenance and the same worldview, yes. And Huawei are part of GSMA. So it actually stands for the Global System for Mobile Communications Association. It's the global industry body for the mobile telecommunications industry, basically, and everything that goes with it. And last week, they had their huge annual event in Barcelona. It's the Mobile World Congress, MWC, Experience the Power of Connection. It looks like this. It is a huge global trade show. It's actually difficult to describe it. I've been to it three or four times in the past. It's absolutely enormous. Everything is there, from the global behemoths like Samsung that you can see in that image there, all the way through to the people making, you know, the little throwaway peripherals that you put onto your phone and everything in between, right? The full industry. I first went there in 2006 when Nokia was king of the world. Facebook didn't even exist. There was no such thing as an iPhone. And since then, we've seen two or three major technological paradigm shifts. And the most recent one, the one that everyone's very excited about, is AI and the AI economy. You can see here, this is a value chain, to use some management consultant speak. You can see all of the different components of the new AI economy, from the microchips to the data centers, the data lakes, the foundation models that are used to analyze all of that data, which is basically you and me, our interactions with the network, by the way. They say data, but it basically means human behavior. The tooling that is used to manage those foundation models, the applications that run on top of all of that data analysis, the app store distribution system, so Apple, Google, and some of the other app stores that are appearing, and then also the developers, and finally the end users, the people who actually use all of this stuff. That is the new economy, end-to-end, and that sits on top of the old economy, right? So if you could just flick back to that last slide, you can see it underneath at the bottom there, it says electrical power and connectivity. And connectivity is what MWC and GSMA used to be about exclusively. So that's network infrastructure, the masks, the switches, the billing systems, customer service, the handset manufacturers, all of that kind of stuff, all in one place, right? This is really the hub of everything. And they're building this future platform. They're going to connect up not just people, but also industries now. So actually consumers have been very effectively wired up to the grid over the past 15 years. You know, we've got well over 100% smartphone penetration in Western Europe, and they're now coming for industries, including heavy industries like advanced manufacturing. They're all going to be wired up across this 5G and now coming next, obviously, 6G telecommunications network. There's a little still here from the video that Mike just referred to a minute ago that he showed on Wednesday from Huawei, where they talk about the fusion of physical, biological, and cyber worlds as a consequence of the rollout of the network. Huawei is a really interesting organization. They're the dominant player now in the global mobile network infrastructure space. They also make handsets as well, but they've made their reputation and most of their money and their market position on the back of network infrastructure. And Huawei was actually founded by a former CCP major. So he was in the Chinese military, then founded Huawei. It's got deep links into the CCP. There's been a lot of controversy about that business as it's grown over the years as a national security issue, ultimately. Like, why would you allow a totalitarian dictatorship to build your core infrastructure? That's a really good question. Running on top of that network are the network operators. So they buy from people like Huawei to build the network infrastructure, and then they run on top of it. So the MWC saw the first meeting, the inaugural meeting of the Global Telco AI Alliance. This is a strategic partnership between four of the largest telco groups. This was signed last year to great fanfare by the chief executives of Deutsche Telekom, E&, which is also now known as, was formerly known as Etisalat, Singtel, and SK Telecom, who between them have covered the thick end of about 1.5 billion customers across all major regions. This is a huge alliance. Let's have a little look at what some of those organizations are up to. So Deutsche Telekom is also working with the World Health Organization to build a digital health app. Right, so let's get that straight up front. Singtel, which is based in Singapore and has nearly 700 million mobile subscribers across the Asia Pacific region. Singapore is really interesting. They've gone hard on investment in AI. Singapore is essentially a fascist state, right? It's a city state. It's probably a model that's being looked to by people like the World Economic Forum for the future of how humanity is going to live on Earth. They've been investing a huge amount of money into artificial intelligence. People like Google are very excited about this. You can see here Caroline Yap, who's the MD of the global AI business at Google, basically saying that in order for AI to deliver its potential, you've got to have really good public-private partnerships, which, as we all know, is fascism. So in order for AI to deliver its full potential, which is what everyone wants, of course, we've got to have a global fascist super state, and then it will work really well. All of this is being enabled, as you would expect, by WEF partners such as Accenture. We can see here Julie Sweet, who's the global CEO of Accenture, meeting with the chief executive of E&, who's one of the members of the AI Alliance. Julie Sweet is also a trustee of the World Economic Forum, so we can essentially see the totalitarian global superstate building the infrastructure that it's going to use to run its international empire right in front of us, issuing press releases. Isn't it fantastic seeing this all play out? Now, there's also a really fascinating, slightly bizarre ideological dynamic to all of this. As I can say that on International Women's Day, little quote here from Julie Teagland, who I've spoken about before. She is unofficially the Obergruppenführer for Europe of Ernst & Young, EY. She talks about AI being a force for good and not being a force for good if it exacerbates existing inequalities in the workforce and, frankly, in society more broadly. So there is an a priori assumption amongst the people building these technologies that our societies have been somehow biased against minorities and women in particular. This was focused at MWC around the Equality Lounge, which was sponsored by AWS, PwC, Verizon, There was a whole bunch of discussion going on around the need to elevate women into positions of power and authority inside the global corporate system. I don't know about you, but I don't really care whether the fascist system is built and run by men or women. I'd prefer that it didn't exist. And actually, ladies, if you're watching this, you are unfortunately leading us into some extremely dark and dangerous territory. I shared this quote a couple of weeks ago. This is from Frank Herbert, the author of Dune. Once men turned their thinking over to machines in the hope that this would set them free, but that only permitted other men within machines to enslave them. And I think that's what we're looking at here. Let's just hear very quickly from Jensen Huang, who's the chief executive of NVIDIA, a specialist AI microchip manufacturer.
I want to say something, and it's going to sound completely opposite of what people feel. Over the course of the last 10 years, 15 years, almost everybody who sits on the stage like this would tell you it is vital that your children learn computer science. Everybody should learn how to program. And in fact, it's almost exactly the opposite. It is our job to create computing technology such that nobody has to program, and that the programming language is human. Everybody in the world is now a programmer. This is the miracle of artificial intelligence. The countries, the people that understand how to solve a domain problem in digital biology or in education of young people or in manufacturing or in farming, those people who understand domain expertise now can utilize technology that is readily available to you. You now have a computer that will do what you tell it to do. It is vital that we upskill everyone. And the upskilling process, I believe, will be delightful, surprising.
So they talk about upskilling. It's not upskilling, it's de-skilling. They do not want us to be able to build the systems that they are building in order to subjugate us, right? That is what's happening here. You can look at this quote just pulled from that video. It is our job to create computing technology such that nobody has to program and that the programming language is human. If you can't build the technology, then you can't break away from the system that they are in the process of building.
Ben, thank you very much for that. Okay, let's move on. If you like what the UK Column does, if you'd like to support us, and we very much need your support, head over to support.ukcolumn.org. All the options to help us out are there. You can pick something up at the UK Column shop, which is shop.ukcolumn.org, but please do share anything you find on the various platforms, especially ukcolumn.org and ukcolumnextracts.co.uk. Now, just a couple more days to take advantage of the early bird pricing for the Climate Science Masterclass with David Siegel. Details on that are at climatecourse.ukcolumn.org. We've had a good response, so it's going to be a fun 12 weeks of 90-minute sessions. So we will look forward to that starting very soon. My interview that went out 1 o'clock yesterday with Jose Vega is on the UK Column website. It's called Guerrilla Warfare for Truth in the Bronx. That got a very good response in the chat box yesterday. So please do go and have a look at that if you haven't seen it so far. And Debbie, very briefly, your No Smoke Without Fire with Brian is up on the website now. And you were looking at the Green King, King Charles.
We are indeed, and this is just part one. There's a couple more parts to come, so I think you'll find it very interesting.
Also, your blog is up.
It is indeed. Facial recognition. No, the Chinese have got gait recognition now. And if you like and enjoy a tipple, no longer can you just pick up your bottle of booze from the supermarket. You might have to buzz for booze, and plenty more in there this week.
And quickly, your Dying of Thirst article, yeah, which followed on from the Midazolam symposium.
Yes, it did. And I think nobody should be dying of thirst in 2024, least of all our elderly and vulnerable and disabled. And this is really an information article, how to spot the signs of dehydration, what to do, and just some of the things to look for and to do if you've got an elderly person in a care home, ask questions.
Thank you, Debbie. Now, quick reminder, second episode of Walking the Dog with Brian will be premiering on his YouTube channel, 11 a.m. on Sunday morning. Get along and listen to that if you can. An evening with Richard Vogue, Sandy Adams, Clive DeCarl, taking place on the 30th of March, 7 to 10 p.m. in Glastonbury. Get along to that if you can. And the AV guys have asked us to remind everybody that they're holding an event also in Glastonbury on Sunday, the 24th of March. Gary Fron will be the main speaker there. And they have sent us a promotional code if you want 10% off the ticket price for that, which is UKC10. So do get along to that if you can as well. And finally, a reminder of Solidarity Rally for Farmers taking place on the 16th of March, 12:30 p.m. in Truro, drive between Archhill and Trafalgar Roundabout. So that will be taking place on the 16th. Now, staying with the farming issue, we need to move on to the Czech Republic, first of all. And as you can see here, they have been taking some lessons from the French farmers, and they've been dumping manure outside the government, offices in Prague. They've been blocking Prague streets with tractors and so on. So the protests in Europe continue to expand. There's the Czech Republic now. But in Poland itself, things have been coming to a head with the protests in Warsaw, the police being deployed over the last couple of days. And they were deployed with their batons, but also with pepper spray, as you will see in a second. They're not just using, I mean, they're pretty large canisters of pepper spray, and they're being pretty indiscriminate about how it was being spread around. So let's have a look at a little bit more footage on this. So quite unpleasant for many people. I believe there was one politician at these protests from Confederacja. And the lovely Ursula von der Leyen had something to say about Confederacja and other similar parties. Let's just have a listen to this.
Our peaceful and united Europe is being challenged like never before by populists, by nationalists, by demagogues, whether it's the far right or it's the far left, whether it is the AfD or the Rassemblement National, the Confederatia or Vazrajdene, the names may be different, but the goal is the same. They want to trample on our values and they want to destroy our Europe. And we, the EPP, will never let that happen.
Ben, they want to destroy our Europe. Who is us? Who is our in our Europe? And, you know, these are parties. Confederacja is a confederation of a group of political organizations in Poland, which might be described as libertarian. But far the labeling of people of far right is nuts.
Isn't it just? I struggle to find words to describe this woman, actually. I mean, who on earth does she think that she is? She should be listening to the people of Europe, not demonizing them. And there is a video from the World Economic Forum, which came back to me as she was speaking just then, where she talks about her mandate. What mandate does she have to be making pronouncements on anything at all? All right, it's absolutely disgraceful.
100%. And of course, you're absolutely right there, because she has not taken her position on the basis of a popular vote, quite the opposite. So anyway, let's move on to back to the UK. And Debbie, the National Health Service.
The National Health Service. Look, I really want to ask people to go and watch the board meetings like I do. And here's just a screenshot of where you can find it on YouTube, the NHS board meeting, 1st of February, 2024. This one was particularly full of diamonds. And I have to say, for people watching, if you rely on the NHS, if you still want to go to the NHS, I have to tell you, the NHS is going, and it's literally going. But I want you to hear it from the horse's mouth. So this is Professor Joe Harrison, who is National Director of Digital Channels. He's also the CEO of Milton Keynes University NHS Trust. See how excited he gets by the app.
I'll start by saying that this board is presiding over what is, I believe, the biggest change in how the NHS engages with its citizens that we have seen for many, many decades. We're in a place now whereby we have got more than three quarters of our adults who have downloaded the app. We've got 97% of our practices able to communicate with those patients. And the numbers just keep growing exponentially. And I just there are lots of numbers that you've heard today, but over 4 million people a day accessed their medical records last week. This is an appetite that we are fulfilling through the NHS app that people didn't necessarily know existed, but is changing the way that our citizens engage with us. And we've only just started. So the last 12 months, we've presided, and Helen and the team have delivered against all of the priorities that were set, and have delivered early on a couple of them. Now, it's not often you can say that about really big tech programs in the NHS. So it is to celebrate, and one should, as a member of this board, you should be celebrating this hugely. But it's so much more than that. From a productivity perspective, from an engagement perspective, and from the way that we can and will change the way that we deliver care across our NHS, it is staggering. And let me just talk about a few of the things that we're doing. We've started over the last 12 months of putting basic functionality into the app. Stuff that people want to be able to look at their appointments, their letters, to engage at a time of their choosing with our NHS. Our citizens absolutely love it. Have we got countrywide coverage yet? Not quite yet. No, we haven't. Is there more to do? Of course there is. It was brilliant hearing about Pharmacy First and 111. It's even better sitting here knowing that we've already integrated 111 onto the front page of the app, that has already got integrated in it the Pharmacy First pathway. And so when we talk about have people picked up the phone to 111, I sort of hope they don't, because we know that those that are using 111 on the app have got better completion rates than those that are using it through the web. And we know that we can move more and more people to managing their own care through the app.
Right, hold on a second. They can look at their appointments. What appointments?
Good question. But what's even scarier really is that you think that 4 million people are accessing their medical records every single day. That means that are we looking at a population of the worried well? We're also looking at 97% of practices. And this, they've only just begun. But that is literally just the beginning. Let's listen to a bit more of what Professor Harrison says, because it gets worse.
At the moment, the app's focused on people that need the NHS to support their illness. We've got a full programme coming up over the next 12 months to move the vaccination screening programmes onto the app, because we know that patients who book their own appointments are more likely to turn up for them. And the more patients we can get screened, vaccinated, the better. We're putting the digital health check onto the NHS app. I have to say, to start with, it's not going to be amazing. And we have to start somewhere, which is allow the patient to order their home testing kit and send it back. Because we know over the next year, 2 years, 5 years, that home testing kit will be available on their phone. It will be available electronically. And if you don't believe me, I looked yesterday at the camera that sits by the bedside that takes all of the vital signs of the patient in front of them without touching the patient. And when you then think about what that might do to the new hospital programme and how that tech can evolve. And when we talked about virtual wards earlier on, how do we connect the virtual ward technology into the NHS app so that citizens can use that and monitor their health data? Most of us have wearables on us. The future of how we use our NHS app and giving our citizens their digital account to manage their own healthcare is stunning. And for those that don't believe, and there are some, we are saying, I think very conservatively, that we want to move a third of all of our health interactions to being digital first over the next 5 years.
Do you want to be moved over to digital first? Because this is going to be hospitals without staff. This is going to be no GPs, there's no pharmacists. And every single person that's downloading the app and using the app is essentially helping to disable the NHS.
Debbie, correct me if I'm wrong, but the majority of people that need the NHS are the elderly. And so these are the people that are the least equipped to go digital, as he wants to do.
Yeah. So if they're in a care home, I'm sure that the staff will all have their digital records on hand, so they won't even be aware of it. They can access them whenever they want.
Okay.
So, keeping on health, let's look at the MHRA. And I did mention last week there have been a few incidents. So if we go to the MHRA annual report and accounts, we can go further into the report to see about health and safety and look at South MIMS in particular. This is biological containment. And you can see that the recent inspections have resulted in a few actions to strengthen procedures, and they're working towards the renewal of a SAPO license. Now, this is to do with animal pathogens, but there have been accidents. There have been three incidents at South MIMS, and these have had to do with autoclaves. Now, autoclaves are sterilization facilities, basically. But they've also had to make improvements to their emergency procedures. These are the accidents and incidents. So three incidents reported under the reporting of injuries. And there you've got also they've made significant improvements in their emergency procedures. Well, aren't we relieved to know that? However, there have been near misses. But apparently, because they're being reported, we don't have to worry as long as they're being reported. So that's the MHRA are having a few incidents with their laboratories, but also the UKHSA. And if we go and look at a Telegraph article that triggered me to go and look at more, we can see that we've got a story here. Britain's outdated pandemic labs need urgent investment spending watchdog warns. So I went to the National Audit Office to look at the report into the investigation into the UKHSA, and this is into their health security campus. We've got the, have you got the first page of the slide there?
Yeah, sorry, we don't, Debbie. We don't.
No, that one. I can see it on screen there.
Oh, this one. That's one. Yeah, right.
That
okay.
one. Yeah, yep. Perfect. Thank you. This is the report that you can go to if you want. Now, if we go to the next one, we can see the facts, because the facts are ridiculous. Now, Porton Down has been out of date for a very long time. So they bought a laboratory in Harlow in Essex. It was an old GSK facility. They spent £400 million on this, and the total cost was meant to be £530 million, but was revised to £888 million to update it to a satisfactory standard. Although now they say it's going to cost £3.2 billion. Because why? They haven't done anything with it. This has been sitting here. This site in Harlow has been sitting there completely empty, despite the fact that Porton Down, amongst other laboratories, and we're talking about a level 4 containment, which is high containment laboratory, we're talking that they were needed, Porton Down was needed to be replaced as early as 2006. I mean, this is how far it goes back. And we're talking about, you know, dangerous pathogens like Ebola and Lassa fever. And the facilities at Porton Down are 55 years old. But despite buying this facility at Harlow, the UKHSA has suspended all of its main construction at Harlow. So the whole project has finished and stopped, whilst we've got Porton Down still functioning, but way below standards. So if you just skip to the next slide, we can see that they've actually stopped everything now. The estimate they're saying was completely wrong. They're replacing the facilities they're saying is a necessary, it's crucial, it's absolutely crucial. But even if they started work now and updated this Harlow lab that they've had empty for so long, it's not going to be operational till 2036. And we've got a lot of laboratories in this country and a lot of high containment laboratories. So what is just around the corner from your housing estate or your village or your town? And how safe is it? Obviously not safe, but the mainstream media aren't reporting about this, are they?
Okay, thank you, Debbie. Now, let's move on, Ben. And, well, we've been talking about cities over the last lot of weeks, but have we been looking about the cities of tomorrow?
Absolutely. The cities of tomorrow, and a lot of this policy around the future cities, the connected cities that we're all going to live in the not too distant future, according to the NHS board meeting, it's right around the corner. A lot of the policy and a lot of the structure, a lot of the technologies are being developed in this country, it turns out. And I think the UK people really need to wake up to this fact, actually. That NHS board meeting was absolutely staggering. I need to go and watch that. Thank you for sharing that, Debbie. So I came across this report earlier this week. I thought it was brand new, actually, but it turns out it came out in June last year. So it's about 6, 7, 8 months old now, but it's still hyper-relevant. And it's a World Economic Forum report. You can see it's called Data for the City of Tomorrow. This is about building the interconnected network of city-states that are going to run across the mobile telecommunications grid that we talked about a little bit earlier in the show. And this is a comprehensive manual, essentially, for municipal governments and their partners to address what they call vexing and seemingly intractable problems of urban governance. So to make better decisions, set targets, benchmark progress, respond to crises, streamline processes, save costs, assess policy impacts, communicate with citizens and partners, improve services and infrastructure, attract investment and talent. This is a blueprint for connected cities. There's a whole bunch of policy information in here, which basically sets out a top-down, step-by-step guide to implementing a data-enabled urban control system, a bit like what we just heard about from the NHS board meeting, which would run on top of the advanced telecommunications infrastructure being built by people like Huawei. Absolutely fascinating to see how they've done this. And essentially, this is a handbook, a playbook. Like you can pick this up anywhere in the world and as someone running a city and use it as a way to roll out this digital control grid. It's being developed, as I said, by the World Economic Forum, but also these two organizations. And this is where it comes back to the UK, right? So you've got the Business of Cities and the Connected Places Catapult. I'll go through each of these a little bit just to explain what they are. So the Business of Cities, well, you can kind of get get it from the name, right? It's like, how do you create a commercial market out of city-states? They call themselves an urban intelligence firm for global business. They focus on urban investment, global benchmarking, leadership strategy, identity and narrative, whole place innovation. We could just skip on. I've run through this one already. I'm not going to read all of these out. You can freeze that and have a look at it. Essentially, what they're doing is working with politicians and businesses to build the infrastructure for connected cities. They've been working internationally for 15 years now. They work with more than 200 cities in 50 countries around the world from their home base in the City of London. This is what I mean when I say that this is being coordinated centrally from the UK. The second organisation is the Connected Places Catapult. These two are very closely linked to each other. This is a UK government organisation funded by UK government. They get nearly £1 billion a year to run their operations. This is part of what is called the Catapult Network. They provide what they call impartial innovation as a service for public bodies, businesses and infrastructure providers to catalyse step change improvements in the way people live, work and travel. Doesn't that all sound very inoffensive and but until you actually get into the detail of it. So what is a connected place? Well, it's a smart city, essentially. So they talk about this relating to the application of today's emerging technologies to the places we live, work and play, the integration of social, physical and digital worlds, a bit like Huawei talked about in that 6G film we referenced earlier, and then building services, government services, essentially, that operate on top of that technology. So this is public-private partnership. This is a blueprint for rolling out global fascism. So why is that all interesting? Well, there's a common denominator between those two organizations. It's this gentleman, Greg Clark, CBE, who is on the advisory board of the Connected Cities Catapult, and he's a co-founder of the Business of Cities, who partnered with the World Economic Forum on this report. He thinks that by 2100 or 2100, I don't actually know how to say that, actually, we'll have 10 billion people living in 10,000 cities. Yeah, so that's the vision for the future of humanity. We're going to be urban. There's going to be about 10 billion people internationally. I don't know if that number's over egg slightly, given that there is apparently a concerted effort towards depopulation. But he's saying here that we're going to have 10 billion people living in 10,000 cities, and essentially that will be it. We'll all be hooked up to this grid. Now, Greg Clark is an interesting character, and I think we're going to be talking about him quite a lot, because he's also the chair of the advisory board of 3CI, which I talked about a few weeks ago, and their activities around the UK with local authorities. I specifically referenced his involvement with Yorkshire and Humberside, where we've got two of the regional mayors here at an event with Greg Clark there, talking about local private collaboration, which is essentially fascism. If we just click on, we can see it's about bringing private sector money into local government in order to build the new energy infrastructure and associated technologies. So as I say, he's on the advisory board for 3CI. We're going to be keeping a very close eye on this organisation. And he sits on there with a couple of other people of note. I won't go into all of it because there's quite a lot to get into here. But the first one that jumps out at me was Sadiq Khan. Obviously, he's involved with this. And the fact that it references Sadiq Khan as not just being the mayor of London or the president of or the co-president of C40 Cities, but also a representative of something called M10. Now, M10, you cannot find any reference to that online at all, apart from in a couple of places. So it seems to be an informal collaboration, and it's actually spoken about in an interview. This is where I got the most information about it. It was this interview carried out with Andy Street, CBE, who's the mayor of the West Midlands. And he essentially talked about, this was a joint interview with Sadiq Khan, he talked about a loose collaboration called the M10 that comes together about once a month. Right? So there's some informal collaboration. Dare we call it conspiring going on between the regional mayors and the mayors of the big metro centres across the UK. That sounds extremely unaccountable. What are these people doing when they get together at M10 to talk about their plans for the future? I think that needs to be investigated further, and we'll come back to you on that point. And then the final person that I wanted to just reference, because she seems to be popping up a lot, is this woman, Lucy Yu. We spoke about her a few weeks back in relation to London Climate Action Week. You remember that, which is coming up in June. And she is on the board or actively involved in an extraordinary number of organisations relating to or working around this climate issue. So she's involved with London Climate Action Week. She's on the advisory board of E3G. She's working with Freud Communications. She is the chief executive of the Centre for Net Zero Policy, which is part of Octopus Group. And we're going to talk about Octopus Group in a couple of weeks because they are absolutely everywhere. And she is also an advisor to the Tony Blair Institute for Global Change. Of course she is. So she and Khan and Greg Clark sit right at the nexus of a bunch of organisations who are very clearly collaborating, conspiring with each other to implement a global digital control system running almost entirely out of central London. I think UK people in particular, it's on us to clean up this mess.
Yes, so let's have a quick look at another similar organization, or at least another similar collaboration, because they're hosting a conference at the moment. This is ReStitch. This is a conference that's been put together by a combination of three so-called think tanks, Labour Together, Create Streets, and Onward. So Labour Together, we'll start with Create Streets, actually, because I think they were the founders of this. They say that they exist to help solve the housing crisis and help neighbourhoods, communities, landowners, councils and developers create and steward beautiful and popular gentle density places where residents and neighbours can love for generations. Our goal is to make it easier to coordinate beautiful, sustainable, prosperous, economically and socially successful places for people, prosperity and the planet. And of course, climate is right at the heart of all this. Onward, which is another one of the two founders of this, is a modernizing think tank, they say, whose mission is to develop bold and practical ideas to boost economic opportunity and strengthen communities in all parts of the United Kingdom. They say they're not affiliated to any party but believe in mainstream conservatism. And then, of course, the new partner in this is Labour Together, built by a group of MPs, Rachel Reeves, Webb Streeting, Steve Reid, Bridget Phillipson, Lucy Powell, Lisa Nandy and John Crudas, who fought to make Labour electable again. And so they're saying that the old certainties are gone these days. China has created a new centre of gravity. War has returned to Europe. The costs of globalised economy have sharpened. In too many places, democracy is in retreat. In this disordered world, Britain is adrift. And so they're going to come in and sort the problem out. So let's have a look at the partners that are involved in this. We've got Grosvenor, Lloyds, Barclay Group, BT, that Debbie's already mentioned. Save Our Wild Isles is there. And in fact, if we look at the bit closer, then who's behind them? We've got the World Wildlife Fund, for example. Now, speaking at this event is Tom Tugendhat. And of course, we've seen him on this programme because he has been talking about the danger that MPs face and that democracy faces at the moment from extremism. We've got to deal with it. And so the purpose of this meeting apparently is because UK politics needs to learn how to disagree well, or it risks descending into what they describe as toxic US-style culture wars. So they issued a statement that says that is particularly true in an election year. How do we restitch communities, empowering local groups and councils to, and ensuring that we're listening to those with direct experience of our crumbling towns and villages? How do we restitch politics, disagreeing well as a society and avoiding the terrifyingly toxic mutual mistrust now common in America? How do we restitch neighborhoods, physically reweaving places scarred by urban dual carriageways or inhumane design? And so what they're talking about is really this is about narrative control and trying to bring people back together, because the society that they have divided through the rhetoric that we've heard from the likes of Tom Tugendhat and his colleagues over the last number of years, that needs to be dealt with, because it's resulted in distrust of politicians and a toxic discussion. Who else is involved with this? Well, Steve Reid, we've mentioned him. He's Shadow Secretary of State for Environment, Food and Rural Affairs. And he's saying that nature is in crisis. While we talk readily about the climate crisis and the need for global action to tackle it, there's far less focus on the nature crisis that's the other side of the same coin. Other speakers include Carlos Moreno, who's, of course, the urbanist and initiator of the 15-minute city concept, Ben Page from Ipsos, Marina Mirza from Civic Future, Oliver Coppard, Mayor of South Yorkshire, Lord Finkelstein, who's a columnist in The Times, Rachel Wolfe from Public First, and Chris Boardman, the former cyclist, who is Commissioner of Active Travel England. Now, we were talking about this last night, Ben, and you had a few comments to me in private about some of these people, but I'd just be interested in your thoughts of this type of initiative, because it seems to be pretty much in the same mould as what as you've been just describing.
Yeah, this is it's all interconnected, isn't it? Right? Like, I mean, it's uniparty, basically. You know, we have these TV programs, scripted TV programs, where, you know, Sunak comes out and makes a big speech and a big statement, and then Starmer says something, and they have a bit of a go at each other in the Houses of Parliament. But none of that actually means anything. It doesn't matter who you vote for, because they're all in the back room having a restitch up conversation with Carlos Moreno, who's literally the guy who invented the concept of the 15-minute city. It doesn't matter what happens in mainstream politics. It doesn't matter what we see on Newsnight or on the 9 o'clock news, if people even actually watch that stuff anymore. These people are conspiring with each other. Yes, this is a conspiracy to implement whatever it is that they want to happen next, as we've just been talking about. It is absolutely grotesque. There are things that I want to say about these people that I cannot say. I can't say them here. I'll get in trouble. And Colin would get in trouble. I have to hold my tongue. This is utterly disgraceful.
Yes. So, of course, it makes a mockery of democracy, if we want to use that word. It makes a mockery of the election process. But these are the types of questions we should be asking our MPs, and we shouldn't be forgetting that there are MPs involved in this, so they are absolutely on board with this conspiracy.
Absolutely, without question, yes. Yeah, I think, you know, there's been a lot of debate, not least on the column forums, actually, about whether there's any point in getting in touch with your MPs or in voting or anything like that. But I think that there is. I think that these people need to feel the pressure, actually. And, you know, just look through today's show. There are at least three or four things here, the NHS board meeting, the stuff that I was talking about, restitch. None of that is acceptable. Not a single piece of it is acceptable. And I think that we've got to let these people know that we won't stand for it anymore. Otherwise we'll get what's coming to us.
That is absolutely correct. Now, you mentioned earlier in passing that this is World Women's Day. I think we've got something to end on here on that topic.
Yeah. International Women's Day, IWD. Oh, ladies, aren't you fantastic? You need your own special day. Look, I can see Debbie screwing her face up over there. I think we're going to get an earful on Extra. But obviously, because it's International Women's Day and because it's 2024 and nothing makes sense anymore, we're going to what do they call it again? We're going to celebrate Pips Bunce. MX, I think, I don't know how you say that, Miss, Mix. Pips Bunce, she, her, they, who has been appointed as one of the UN, the UK's representatives to the UN Women Summit. And Pips is, if it wasn't already clear from the MX and the they and the fact that it looks like a fella in a wig, because that's what it is, that isn't actually a woman, and I probably just got myself in a bunch of trouble for saying that, haven't I? So goodness me, what a world we live in anyway.
Oh, you won't be getting into any trouble from anyone here, I don't think. Well, that is indeed a great example of the world that we live in. So on that note, we will leave it for today. We will be back in a few minutes if you're a UK column member for some extra, where undoubtedly we'll be discussing this in a bit more detail. If you're not a UK column member, please consider joining and join us for Extra on a regular basis. But otherwise, have a great weekend. We will see you on Monday. See you then. Bye-bye.